Okay, so I'm still here with Dan Udell after some technical difficulties on June 5th, 2013 here in Hudson, New York. And before our technical difficulties, you were telling the story about how you and your wife, Mary, came to Hudson, and I have many questions about your school, the work in the schools, and what brought you to that. But before I ask those, because your wife figures so prominently in all of your stories in your life, I would love to just hear how you guys met.
Oh, we met in Stamford, Connecticut, at a singles group, believe it or not, at the Unitarian Church. And it was in 1983, between Christmas and New Year's, and one of the first times I attended that group, the same for Mary. And we're just talking about what we're going to do for New Year's. And she was well occupied, I think. She was going to several parties. And I said, you know, I really don't like New Year's anyway, and the idea of parties turns me off, and that was that. But I began to look at her. She was at another table, and became interested in Mary and what she had to say, and she was she had an art gallery in Portchester, New York. So guess what? I guess a day or two before New Year's, I called her and said, "Hey, what are you doing for New Year's?" Which is interesting, because I can look at the world conceptually, or I can look at it through somebody's eyes, and it's much better to look at somebody's eyes, and it changes. The mind follows the body, I think, always, and it certainly did in that case. So we went to several parties that she had lined up and had a wonderful time. And on the way, she showed me an sculpture garden, rather, in downtown Portchester that she had converted from a garbage-strewn abandoned lot. And there was this beautiful set of sculpture there. And the snow was coming down, and it gave everything a look, the look of a... what is the word? Serigraph? Lithograph. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I think I probably fell in love with her that night. So it was pretty much love at first sight. Despite all my protestations about not liking New Year's. New Year's was not the point. Mary was the point. So that's how we got started. And I helped her at the gallery there in Portchester. We since moved the gallery to Stamford, Connecticut for a few years. And then later to Cross River, which is on Route 35, between, I guess it's between Ridgefield and Katona, New York. We finally gave up the gallery after about 20 years because it just wasn't making any financial sense whatsoever. But we met many, many artists and wonderful people. Still know them, still get to see them. And she also is a curator at RPI, their gallery up there, as well as in Hudson, the Stageworks Theater as a gallery. So she's still occupied doing curatorial work. So that's how we sort of got together. And we shared a love of travel and biking and just general love of life. So, and this was for both of us after a second career, you might say, and in marriage and family. We have 7 children between us and 14 grandchildren. I have two girls and two boys, and she has three daughters. And we get to see them regularly. Of course, my kids are spread all over the countryside, so it's harder for me. Mm-hmm. Hers are pretty local, mm-hmm. New York and New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I'm Connecticut, Massachusetts, Georgia, and Florida. What else can I tell you?
Well, I guess after, I'm interested in a whole bunch of things around the school work that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my first question would be, you talked a lot about what you do and your love of kids and, mm-hmm. and what, but I'm interested in what did attract you to doing the school? Like what pushed you over into doing that work?
Well, it was meeting with the then principal, Mr. Spicer. And this was in response to the Michelle Obama email. And we went to him and said, you know, we'd love to volunteer. And we thought of education, just generally. We didn't have any specific ideas. And we got talking with him, and he suggested working with kids. And I told him about my video background. He said, gee, you know, why don't you do a video class? Mm-hmm. So we did. So it was sort of, you know, natural, organic. And all the while, they were mostly with challenged students of one type or another, academically, emotionally, what have you. And then we also got involved through Parents in Partnership with a wonderful woman, Ellen Henderson, who started Parents in Partnership. And it was really to be advocates for children, for students who are getting a raw end of a deal in the school system. So those things combined, really. That's it.
And can you talk about more about what the Hudson schools are like and what kinds of challenges kids might face here?
Well, they're I don't want to get too controversial, but I probably will. You know, there are the haves and the have-nots. There are some kids who are not part of the college-bound group, and there are those who are not. And I think this is true everywhere, particularly true here. And also, we mentioned before the referral system in the school system. And we think that minority kids are disproportionately given some kind of a referral or suspension, if you will. And it goes from in-school suspension to out-of-school suspension. The problem is when you're suspended out of school, the state mandates that you have to educate the child. But what is the education you receive? You receive 2 hours of training, of some kind of instruction during the morning, and then the rest of the afternoon you're off. So you're not getting equivalent education. So if you're on a slippery slope to begin with, you're going to go faster down that slope. That's part of the problem. And in addition, you are cut off from your... you're not really allowed to be on school property except to enter the classroom where you're going to receive training, tutorial training, and your exit. So from a number of points of view, if you started off in trouble, you're going to be in a lot more trouble. And it's a vicious cycle, and it really needs to stop. The other kids, you know, we work with kids who are doing well. This one guy Winston Lee, who was a really good, we got very involved with him. He's a black, wonderful kid and doing well in school. He had been in trouble and he got himself out of it, he says, through the youth center in town. It's down on 3rd Street. And we're big supporters of that. We know the people down there. And he said he put himself on his on the right path by getting involved in sports down there. And he, last fall, we got a campaign together and got somebody to put up the money to send him to a national football combine, if you will. And he did quite well for himself down there. So he's a junior now, I think, and he's hoping to get some kind of a scholarship. And we talked him into also joining the track team because he's so fast, so incredibly fast. Guess what? He is now the top sprinter in New York State. He does the 100-yard dash in 10.3 seconds. So think 1,001, 1,002. Yeah, by the time you're finished counting to 10, he's gone the length of a football field. And we've taped him on a number of occasions at the meets. We do that too. And we do a lot of videotaping of school events to help the kids appreciate themselves, you might say. We did that for just 2 nights ago. The middle school had a concert of their kids, both fifth and sixth grade bands and their chorus. And so we're going to give those back to the school, and hopefully they'll play them. The teachers will use them. So we will try and find those areas in the school where, you know, we can make a difference somehow or other. So we don't have a big plan. We just sort of rattle around and look for opportunities. Where could we help? Where could we help the most? That's the key. So what was your other question? I forget.
I think I only asked one at stuff, but one thing I'm interested in is what your relationship with these kids is. What's your relationship with these kids like?
Well, mostly in a classroom setting, although it goes beyond that. We this one student who was expelled finally from school, and we can't just throw him under the bus. He's still in the 9th grade. He's about 17 now. School just isn't working out for him, so we're trying to find alternatives for him. And we did represent him. Didn't turn out too well, but so, you know, we try to help him. I need some yard work, and so he comes out to our house and does yard work, and we went trout fishing a week or so ago. And unfortunately, I caught the trout, and he didn't. But he got to eat them. So, so you know, we get attached to the kids, and on an individual basis, you know, we try to help them. But you know, the numbers are too big. You know, you can't help everybody, and so there's a personal interaction we have, and then also in the classroom. Is that me or you?
I think it might be you.
Oh, yeah. I got a pull over or something. You're hearing something coming over?
Yeah, I think. Hmm. You know, sometimes the phone will, will do that thing. So, So you're working in the schools in all of these different ways. Like, mm-hmm. what would your vision for a healthy school system look like? Like, what does that look like? I think especially here in Hudson.
Well, good question. I'm not really sure. Another thing we did, we videotaped, was International Day. This was a couple of weeks ago. And the kids put it on. This teacher that we work with, one of the minority teachers here, they with kids from, there's a wide variety of cultures and nationalities represented in Hudson in particular that you'd never see in the Taconic Hills. And they put on an International Day. They had little kiosks and table set up of food from different areas, France and Bangladesh and India. It was wonderful. And they had dancing. It's marvelous. So what would a, you know, what, you want to do everything. That's the problem. You want to help the kids who want to go into college. You want to help kids who want a music career. You want you really want to expose, we did talk about this a bit. You want to expose kids to as much as possible, because it's only through their interaction with an outside influence that they realize. I mean, take Mozart. Suppose Mozart's father was an attorney, right? I mean, it could have been. And suppose he had never seen a violin or a piano. Could have happened. It was only through exposure that something happens, you know? So you got to expose them to all kinds of stuff. And then you have to have the ability to follow up and give them the training, not the training particularly, but the exposure that they need to these wonderful life influences. So what does that look like? I don't know. You know, you need more teachers, I think. You need more time. You need in particular, you need teachers who, well, they're beginning to do it. It's beginning to happen, and we get involved with Maria Sudmeyer. She fortunately gives us entree to some of her meetings, and we can give our ideas. But right now, they're talking about, I forgot the term for it. It's really cross, what's the term? Cross-curriculum, I guess they're calling it. So if you're taking math, I majored in math, and I never heard about the history of math. You know, you did through so-and-so's theorem or so-and-so's algorithm. But you never really heard about the history of that person and the struggle they had. And the thing that amazed me when I got out of school was you could devote your entire life to one theorem or one algorithm or one little piece of a medical puzzle your entire life, but it comes at you in school just like a blizzard, and you think, oh, you're knocking these things off every week. No, you're not. It's the world's discovery coming at you, but it doesn't work, it doesn't get uncovered that way. So what was my point? To begin to mix up the curricula, to give a more realistic flavor of what's happening. And just take math. You know, hey, do a little history, for God's sakes, you know. It makes it more interesting. It gives you deeper meaning. You can take any subject material, certainly, you know, history. But, well, some of the bigger problems, though, some of the big issues are last year we had Walter Dean Myers. Now, I've forgotten his exact title. He's the U.S., the U.S. Poet Laureate, but for children's literature. I've forgotten his exact title. Wonderful person, and I love his stories. He said that he was raised I guess either a foster mother or not by his maternal mother. who loved romance magazines. And she would sit him on his knee, her knee, and he would sort of share in these stories. And he never, but that's how he got exposed. And again, the exposure idea, he got exposed to stories and books that way. But he says that a child from an impoverished neighborhood comes to school with a vocabulary of 1,500 words. A kid from an affluent community comes in with 45 to 5,000 words. And he says, you know, they never catch up. You can't. How do you catch up? You're 4 or 5 years old now. And most of your learning really happened a few years ago. I was going to make a point. I forgot what it was. Exposure. The family is a big deal here. You know, what are the kids coming to school with? And we're seeing it. Some kids don't get breakfast. And then the lunches are, you know, not the most appetizing things I've ever seen in the whole world. So I think a lot of kids come to school hungry. You can't learn if you're hungry. You can't learn well anyway. And then there are other problems. So there's a whole host of out-of-school problems that these kids are grappling with in addition to their academics. Same token, you've got kids who don't have those problems, and they ought to have a break too. So you've got to feed both ends of the spectrum. Hard, really hard. And I think with Maria at the helm, we're going to do a really great job because she knows it. She's been here, and she knows what the problems are. Mm-hmm. Things like Hudson Reads, this mentoring reading program for kids. You know, 100 people from the community are now being mentors to these kids. And you say, oh, it's only an hour a day. You know, but that makes a difference. It's 1 hour where the kid, we've seen it. We've got Mr. Ed, he's one of the ministers here in town, and we got talking. It was an interfaith council meeting of all the ministers in town. We got talking about our volunteer work, and he got to us after the meeting. He said, you know, I'd like to help. What are you guys doing? I said, you gotta go to this mentoring program. And he did, and he has formed a bond with this Brendan. This kid, minority kid, they have an absolute bond. And he was in one of these classes we had of troubled kids. He's come a long way since, but now he's doing just beautifully. But you can see it. Kids need to be able to relate to an adult, to a human being, you know, on some level. And I'm afraid a lot of them don't have that opportunity. But, you know, what do you need? You need so many things. It's, in, you know. And, of course, then you're fighting also, and I get in my soapbox here, the industries, the food industry and the movie industry and the gaming industry, they're spending billions of dollars in marketing, wedging themselves between the kids and the parents. I know this is true. I mean, I spent years at IBM. They didn't do that, but I saw how it happens. I saw what goes on. And big money is being spent so that the mentors are no longer the parents, they're the music person, the tough guy in films, you name it. And it's a big problem, it's a huge problem. But I think by exposing kids one-on-one, eyeball to eyeball, you can overcome that. So that's what we need to do. and also get rid of these things. Because that's another thing that we would find. The kids would be looking at us, but they're really texting with this thing under the table. And that, they can do it just by touch typing with their thumb. So it is a problem, the distraction. You know, when I was a kid, you had radio. That's all we had. Then we had TV, but first it was just radio. Not much distraction. Phones were at home. Where else would you find a phone, right? So, more questions?
Well, what, since you brought up your childhood, what was your childhood like?
Oh, it was an idyllic childhood. We lived out in the country in Westchester County. There was a farm across the street that used horses to plow their fields. And we'd get our milk by going down to a dairy farm down the road. Got picked up by a bus to a school, Roosevelt Elementary School. Typically normal childhood without any problems. Nothing remarkable. Somehow or other, and I don't know how it happened, I became a liberal as a young child. And my father would come out with some outrageous remarks, anti-Semitic remarks and racial remarks. And as maybe a 4 or 5 year old, we were raised a very religious family, Methodist family. And I know all of the Old Testament stories, all the New Testament stories. I know it all. And I guess I listened and learned. And then I heard what was being said in my family, and I'd cringe. There was that. There was that element. That's where it came from, because I had no other outside influences. I was just a kid living way out in the country, and then come into school and church, and that was my exposure to society. So where else could it have come from? I don't know. So I listened and I learned. You know? Well, one Sunday, you got to give him credit. This was, good God, this was in the 40s. You know, I'm old. I'm very old. This is in the 40s, and I was sitting there, so I was like, I was 7. And every year, we had a Black Methodist church and a White Methodist church in town, and you'd exchange choirs and ministers. And the deacon, I guess, of our church got up at the lectern there, and he said, you know, we are really happy to be able to have you niggers up here once a year. It is really great. And I just thought, I'm 7 years old. Now, nobody ever told me don't ever use that word. Matter of fact, my father used that word. And I thought I would just sink into the woodwork. So where did that come from? I don't know, but it did. So I knew at that age. And so, it just sort of grew with me. Been a Democrat forever, big Obama supporter. Myself and my wife are just absolute fanatics on hearing about World War II and the Holocaust. Matter of fact, I did a wonderful interview with somebody, Lily Harvett from Chatham. I did a documentary on her and her experience. I have it if you'd like to see it. And incredible story. She was in Holland, in Amsterdam, and only a few blocks away Frank. Yes, thank you. And Frank, yeah, just a few blocks away. And she was, they had to split up families, and she was taken. She and her brother were split up, and they were given to this Christian family, and it was a dentist, and she lived in their second story. Could not go out because they were Germans across the street. She could not look out the window because they might see her. So they kept her incommunicado to the world for 3 years, I guess. And look, touching stories that her, she had a sister, an adopted sister there, a little older than she, who played the violin, and she made a toy violin for her out of a little cigar box and some other things. And she would, during the day, stand in front of her adopted sister's music stand and pretend she was playing. She became a very good violinist after the war. But just horrific stories that most of her family of 80 people, her father and mother survived, oddly enough. The rest of the family was annihilated at Sobibor. Incredible. Well, then also, our next door neighbors, right after the war, so I was 10, I guess, yeah. They came from Holland, and they were refugees, and they had lived through the war, and they also had been hidden. He was a resistance fighter, and she and her daughter were hidden during the war. Made a huge impact on me, just incredible. To see somebody real, you know. I heard stories, but there's a real person. So I guess that's how it all evolves. You hear one thing, you connect to another and another.
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like my next question was going to be, when or how did this liberal or progressive streak in you come up in your life? And it sounds like it sounds like it's been there.
Oh, it's been there. Yeah, sure. Oh, it's been there. I didn't have a chance to express it very much when I was working for IBM. I had some marvelous jobs. I can't knock them. I was there, became a science writer, and was in charge of their science writing at the famous Watson Research Center for many years, and they sent me down to represent them at the space program. They did all the computers for Space Shuttle. And then I went on to be in charge of communications for their software group. And then I was in World Trade, and I went all over the world. Wonderful. But you had no time to do anything. And I had a family of, you know, four kids, and so I lived a very normal life. I didn't have time for much else. But then Mary and I met up, and Mary is a real activist, and I must admit she would give me a little kick in a fanny. I always agree with her. It wasn't that I disagreed. It was just too lazy or, you know, whatever. My momentum would just carry me along with whatever I'm doing. So we're a little different that way. I am very focused. I mean, I'll focus on something and I'll do it. Mary gets involved in 10 things at the same time. So we're a good couple. Matter of fact, I just did a book. I always wanted to do it, and I finally did it. An e-book on Photoshop, because I use a lot of Photoshop. And I met up with this guy from Vernon, Connecticut, who does... that's the new wave now. You do e-books, and you put them on Amazon, or you can buy the DVD now. And what it is, it's a voice, my voiceover, showing people how to get involved in Photoshop. You know, here's the screen, here's the cursor, and here's... So a lot of animation on the screen with a voiceover. So, but that was one of my... So for the first 3 months of this year, that's all I did. Well, in addition to doing what we do. So I can do that I'm exhausted at the end, but then, you know, I'm ready to do something else. Mary will always come at me with 10 different ideas. They're all good. They're all good. So it's a good combination. Yeah, we haven't talked about each other, or I haven't talked about my relationship with Mary, which is really excellent. I must say, she brings out the humanity in me that's there that might not emerge because of my single-mindedness. Just not that I don't care, just I get so involved in whatever I'm doing, you know, I'll just do it to the exclusion of everything else. But this helps because I do a lot of, obviously, we do a lot of publications. We're just doing one, I forgot to tell you. Mary's idea, this town again is a bunch of silos and they have all these things for the summer. This organization, that organization, they're all good organizations, but they don't talk to each other. TSL, the Opera House, the Youth Center, the school, you name it. And she said, wouldn't it be a great idea to have a booklet for parents? Here you are in May, you're thinking, what am I going to do for my kids this summer? You don't want them to fall behind. I want them engaged, but where, how? And so a very simple idea, but brilliant idea to put a booklet together. It's 18 pages now, and everybody has a page. Elena Mosley, Operation Unite, the Youth Center, you name it. Third year, and very, very successful, and we've gotten funding for it to produce the book. You know, it costs money. I do all the design and the Photoshop stuff and all that. And we give it to our printer in just a series of PDF pages. And he assembles it. And so another combination where Mary and I work together. She is not a technical person. but she is a big idea person. So... there was I forget what else we were covering there.
Well, I think another thing that I was going to ask and you started talking about was sort of compassion. And that's when you're talking about things and the work that you do, the community work that you do, that's what comes to mind for me. And you explain some of the barriers that you faced earlier in your life around compassion, but like, what does this work that's centered around compassion, I think, what does it bring to you?
Oh, well, deep satisfaction, a sense of reward, but mostly satisfaction to be able to, you know, I look back at my IBM career and I did a lot of great stuff. But it doesn't have any emotional attachments, you know. It doesn't have any personal attachments, and they were one of the best companies around. You know, I met a lot of nice people, great people to work with. I really enjoyed my time there, and they would give me a new job every 2 years. I guess I was doing something good, but if you sum it all up, what can I say about it? Not much, really. If I look at what I've done here in the last few years, we have met more people that we really enjoy and like to be with in the last 4 years than we have in our entire lives before. Because we get to see them on a real basis, on a helping basis. And they know what we're about, and we know what they're about, and we don't kid each other. You know, we're very open about what we're doing. I don't want to get maudlin, but, you know, we're not kids anymore, and we're getting this, I'd call the sunset of our lives, and when you get to that point, you begin to think, well, you know, when am I going to leave? And now we can say, hey, we're leaving something. You can depart gracefully, exit stage left, and do it with a smile, as opposed to having that sense of being unfulfilled. Yeah, so means a lot.
You talked a little bit about the media and your interest in the
media. Oh, sure.
Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Oh, well, again, it was a sense of compassion, I suppose, for the other side. You know, I was a press officer for IBM, and in that role, you have to play both sides of the fence. I knew the corporate culture. I knew what could be said and what couldn't be said, how you had to appear and how you could never appear. And then I also had a lot of friends in the news media, and I knew what they were all about and what they needed. And I was the intermediary between the two, and I knew it full well. And so you were a translator every minute of the day. But at times it gets in the way of your humanity. I remember talking to a reporter once, and I was chatting. I thought I was chatting. And he said, "Hey, Dan, are you reading from a script?" I said, "No, I'm just talking to you." He said, "Gee, it sounded like you were reading from a script." I thought, uh-oh. And I finally got out of that. I left it and got into internal communications. I think this is Mary. There. I got into internal communications. Hello there, voicemail. No? To get away from that, because the stress was too much for me. I didn't feel like being the bridge, the human bridge between these two disparate elements in our society. And I had great fun doing the other.
Well, I'd love to check in with you about time.
Wait a minute, I think. Hello, Mary?
Hi.
Hey, where are you?
Outside here, where are you?
Oh, I'm upstairs. Okay. We're just finishing up here. I'll be right down. Okay. Bye. I thought she had sent me a voicemail, but anyway, she didn't.
Well, since we're wrapping up, is there anything else that you want to add or talk more about that you've brought up? You've brought up so many different...
I don't think so. I think you've pretty well exhausted me.
I'm sure. I don't think that's true. I have a sneaking suspicion that's not true. Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Been a pleasure.